This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you feel like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things you love are checked by experts. And not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff with real, hands-on authentication experience. So when you see that shiny blue checkmark that says Authenticity Guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know that eBay's got your back. Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
One of the things that is the most delicious to me, when something is raw and primitive and executed in elegant, precise lines. And that's what I've been trying to do all my life.
What do you think frightens you?
Well, imprecision, probably. I want everything as precise as possible. I want organization. I want control. Everybody wants control. And I recognize that it's kind of a useless pursuit, but while I'm here, I am going to be as controlled or control everything about me as much as I can.
Hi, this is Imran Ahmed, founder and CEO of The Business of Fashion, and welcome to the BOF podcast. Men's Fashion Month has just concluded, but you wouldn't know it by looking around the lockdown cities of Paris and London and Milan, where designers would have normally been showing their collections to the wider industry. This month, they were all relegated to showing their collections virtually again. But one of my favorite things about Fashion Month has been to eavesdrop on the conversation between our editor-at-large, Tim Blanks, and the designer, Rick Owens. So we thought maybe we could share a little bit of one of those conversations with you, because Tim's been going about reviewing collections as normal and interviewing designers via Zoom. Today we have a very special conversation between Tim and the designer Rick Owens, who always has the most fascinating perspectives to share on everything that's happening in the world. So here's Tim Blanks and Rick Owens inside fashion.
I meant to be Zooming from such a much more picturesque place, but this is the only place I could get internet. I'm in a rectory.
Oh, really?
We're doing the show from the rectory.
Really? Where? I thought you were doing the show in
Lido.
In the Lido.
Yeah. So I'm doing it at the Tempio Votivo, which is at the main dock of Lido. So when you're getting the Vaporetto from Venice to Lido, this temple is the main monument at this dock. And, the whole COVID and having to negotiate doing shows during this period, it's been this great exercise in how do we reduce and how do we do something that's modest, that's kind of respectful of the moment. And, you know, we're not making all these people travel all over the world to come see us. So it's mainly our team from Concordia, the factory. And it's like the five of us who create the collections, like every collection. And they're here from they're with me from the inception. But now they're here for the resolution. They're here working backstage on the show itself, which they've never done before. And then some of these people have been with me 18 years. And so for us to be able to nurture and develop the collection to this point together, we've never fully done that before. And And so it's been this amazing kind of, it's been this great bonding exercise because we're all playing together in a new way. And, you know, they're 2 hours away. So they just drive the collection here and we do, it's like, you know, putting up a play in our backyard. And not having an audience turns it into this different, it's kind of a personal ritual because there is no audience here. We're just kind of doing it for ourselves. And we send these models out to march around a monument and kind of in front of nobody and with, you know, fog and loud music. It's the funniest thing. And it's lovely. It's this, it's turned out to be this lovely experience.
But you know, the last show and in the Lido, the women's show that you did, it was the same thing. The models marched out, there was smoke, there was loud music playing in the piazza. And it was one of everyone's favorite shows of the season. So it was the same kind of setup in a way.
Well, the important thing, the reason why I think it felt good was because it was defiant. We were going to do the best that we could under adverse circumstances. We were going to fight back. We were not going to sit back and be complacent. We were going to do our very best under tricky circumstances. And I think that is the message that is one of the best messages I've ever encountered. And I want to give voice to that energy. There were a couple of seasons where I was kind of gloomy, and I wasn't as galvanized, I guess. But now I'm more than ever, after all of this time, I'm more determined. I mean, if things are bad, you've just got to step it up.
Well, now we've had a year of this, and it looks like it's going to go on for a while longer. And I just always think back to that conversation we had where you said, do you think this is the one? And I said, no, I don't think so. And now, of course, The Stand is on television. Stephen King's The Stand is on television, and the new version of it. And that is the one in that movie. But, you know, it's a year later, and now those temporary adjustments that people made have sort of settled in as a kind of permanent response. People have adjusted their lives to cope with this new set of circumstances. Do you feel you're now in the sort of groove of this, that now, you know, it's almost like there will be no more surprises. This is what it is now. And so you're doing what you're doing without an audience. I mean, how has everything changed in every way for you?
Well, I don't participate or circulate in the world as much as a lot of people do. So my life is not that different. I have a pretty reserved life that's very, you know, I live pretty much in an Italian village, and it's a lot different from an urban environment where this kind of impact is just a lot more dramatic. So in my little corner of the world, there's been change, but it's been quiet change. I like the idea of working within small boundaries. I like the idea of doing the best with what you've got. And so I'm not saying that I've enjoyed it. That wouldn't be very respectful, but it hasn't been painful. And there's been a side to me that thought, well, some kind of global discomfort was bound to happen. It's been a long time since there's been a war. We've lived very privileged lives, and if there is a little hardship, so be it. I mean, it's about time, kind of. So, but going back to the Tempio, what I didn't say about the Tempio is that it is a war monument, and it's an ossuary. So they has it. Is that the right way to say it? Ossuary, yeah. Where they have the. And I didn't know that. I didn't know it was actually an ossuary until yesterday. And I was going, oh, no wonder they wouldn't give us a permit to do a show inside. I totally get it now. Anyway, I only wanted the outside anyway, because it's the outside. When at the end of a night, when you take the Vaporetto from Venice back to Lido at the end of a night, that is when I see that the lights on this monument from across the water, that's like, oh, I'm almost home. It's this familiar part of my life. And it's a very comforting one. And just, it's very linear and kind of Art Deco. And it's kind of my ideal palace. Like if I was gonna have a palace. So it's very personally significant for me. So being able to do these shows where in the casino, where the place that I walk past every day on the way to the beach, and this monument that like signals me almost getting home, it's been the loveliest thing. And then being able to share it with our team, who, you know, it really kind of is our backyard, that has been very fulfilling. The collection itself, when I looked at it this, when I was looking at the headlines on the news this morning, and, you know, it was all about what do we feel now? We feel joy, like, you know, optimism and the happiness about inaugural news. And I was thinking, wow, maybe this collection is just going to hit the wrong note now, because this collection was conceived during a very dark period, and you know, we're entering an optimistic period now, and maybe this is just maybe this just isn't the moment. But even though there is all of this hopeful news, I can't, and I'm an optimist. I just am. I mean, I seem like a pessimist, but there's a drive in me to do, you know, that I'm not a nihilist. There's a drive in me to, even though things could be, seem insurmountable, you're put on this earth to do the best with what you've got. So, and just make it work. So even though there's that optimism in me, there's also a brooder. I also brood, and it's an optimistic moment politically, but there's that darkness inside of me thinking that is just horrified that it was so close. How could that possibly be? Why wasn't it an overwhelming landslide? How could it be so close? And that darkness is still there, and that anger is still there. And so it's kind of an angry collection.
I was just going to say, you say you're an optimist. You talk about the ossuary, and I can't think of anybody else who could put a sort of domestic gloss on an ossuary. There's the lights to guide me. There's home. There are the lights to guide me home. What war is the ossuary from? What, first or second?
I think it's the first. Even though it looks like it was built in the 30s, I think it was built earlier, but I, you know, I should have researched that a little bit more. I should have respected it a little bit more to give it a little bit more spec. But we'll have to Google. I mean, I did Google, but I just didn't retain it. I can't retain everything.
My brain's a sieve, but I blame
bullshit. Them. You retain everything.
I blame the pandemic. My brain's a sieve. It's true though that this collection, reading your notes, is it feels particularly intense.
I know.
I mean, I'm picking out the words horror, male conservatism careening off rails, unhinged, barbaric, suppressed rage. It's interesting because you don't usually go there. So I'm endlessly intrigued. And also the idea of Gethsemane, of course, the garden where Christ was betrayed. I mean, consummate symbol of betrayal. You know, we may come back to reflect on this at some point and say Rick was onto something.
Well, I don't think it's prescient. I think it's just an observation over what's happened. It's just not, it's just observational. And like I said, I mean, reading the room, maybe it's just frustration that just I should have shut up about, but that doesn't mean anything to anybody moving forward. But there is that darkness in me. Like, how could that have been so close? Why? Yeah. Like, it's still there.
Oh yeah. And you know, above and beyond what has been happening in America over the last four years, and what everybody is so glad seemed to have been addressed and kind of revoked yesterday. There is still the climate crisis, which is the backdrop for everything that's happening, and which is much more of a fundamental threat to the human species than anything that the human species is capable of doing to itself, almost. So
I guess it just doesn't feel immediate enough yet, but it will. So we'll get to that when we get to that.
But getting to the collection, I mean, we can start with an optimistic moment, which is the Ramones, your love of the Ramones, which is a sort of foundation stone here, isn't it?
Partly, but it's also another example of doing the best with what you've got, and also within limited means. The music is very minimal, very precise. Everything about them is so precise, which is so funny because they appear to represent rebellious chaos. But actually, everything that they do is so precise and calculated and rehearsed, and not in a bad way. But I mean, it's very organized. I mean, their look, the music is very consistent and very simple. And elegant, just elegant in its simplicity and consistency and purity, kind of. But it's great because the execution is so raw and primitive. And that is one of my most delicious, one of the things that is the most delicious to me, when something is raw and primitive and executed in elegant, precise lines. And that's what I've been trying to do all my life. I don't know if the Ramones was mainly about that, the Converse collaboration. And I loved the poetic circle that we closed after they agreed to their grafting my crude version of my inspiration from them. They are grafting that onto the originals, and I love that circle. How, you know, 18 years ago or whatever, whenever I first started doing my sneakers that were kind of exaggerated cartoons, similar to theirs, after all of this time, we're able to kind of, we're doing a clash, a smash up. Is that what it's called? Like when you,
a mashup.
A mashup.
Mashup. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, starting with you know, I can't even say the word Gethsemane.
We just call it Geth.
Yeah, Geth. Gethsemane. Yeah. Very hard word to say. We can sort of tie that into your spiritual evolution over the past few decades. If you think every show has a sort of as a trigger, a kind of spirit trigger. Why that particular one at this moment? I mean, it is a garden, which is interesting. It is, which represents growth and rebirth, I suppose. But like I said, it also is a place where Jesus was betrayed and where he, but where he awaited his betrayal, knowing it was coming.
Knowing it was coming and preparing himself. And a lot of descriptions are of it are that he's agonizing, that it's there's agony involved, which I'm not into that part of it. I'm thinking that it was a retreat, knowing that there was a difficult resolution ahead and preparing oneself. Preparing oneself. It was really about that, like collecting yourself and being getting ready and preparing yourself to meet some kind of resolution as best you could.
And were you finding a parallel with your own situation in that?
I was feeling that. I don't. I feel they're not that personal, my motivations. I'm thinking about what we're all feeling. I'm thinking about if I'm feeling this, a lot of people are feeling, or like most of us are, because, you know, we're all unique and very special, but we're all also very common. We all share a lot, and we're all sharing this this situation, and I was just sorting out my own feelings, and it's a moment of suspense. It's a moment of it was a moment of suspense. I mean, one decision has been made, but it's still suspenseful. I mean, relating to climate change and just relating to the dark forces that almost were. And then, you know, we're waiting for this health crisis to find some kind of resolution. So it just was a very suspenseful period. And I think that's what Gethsemane meant to me, like that suspense before something happens.
I also think you love King of Kings, don't you? That's one of your favorite movies.
And you know, I've never actually read the Bible. I mean, I've just read passages. But I respect it as some kind of manual that people, that somebody put together. It's supposed to be representational or allegorical, but it's a manual on human behavior and how to negotiate life. And it can be seen as a helpful manual for people to kind of refer to see how it could be organized, your life could be organized, or it can be taken very literally, of course, and create holy wars. But it kind of represents the history of the world, and the history of humanity, and the history of human behavior, and the history of human urges, and And it's sophisticated in the sense that it wants to create order, but it's also incredibly primitive, talking about the basest of human urges. But ultimately, it's about trying to untangle the mess and find order in it and find the most positive resolution. So I'm not religious at all, and I don't do yoga, I don't do meditate or anything. I mean, I take naps. That's my meditation. But I'm kind of fascinated by it, just as like this ancient, primitive, primal manual of life.
Yes, survival manual. Yeah, it is.
And also referring to it, whenever I refer to it, whenever you bring it up, it puts whatever I'm doing into a different context. It isn't about red carpets. It isn't about celebrities. It isn't about collaborations. It's about the history of the world. It puts it in a bigger scale. It puts it in human urges. It puts it in that kind of context, as opposed to what is this season's trend in fashion. It takes it even out of fashion.
But when you, I mentioned King of Kings, which was DeMille, wasn't it? It was Cecil B. DeMille, a silent, yeah. And Gethsemane is in King of Kings, is it?
And actually there's a scene, the crucifixion sequence is just, it really is still kind of moving. It is so, the effects, and it's just so, it's really intense.
Yeah. But I'm thinking that there's quite a lot of hoods in this collection.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm thinking about the influence of those films on your, not the Bible, but those Bible derived films.
You know what those hoods are? Those hoods are about modesty too. I mean, I like the biblical part of them because they suggest some kind of monastic restraint. But it's also about practicality. It's about modesty, because I hate umbrellas. I hate walking down the street because I'm just at my height is just at that level where they're always coming really close to my eyes, you know, with people with umbrellas. And people with umbrellas, that sense of entitlement of taking up all of that space when you could wear a hood. Hood is like the most modest, polite thing to do. It's just self-contained. You are not getting in anybody's way, and it does the job. But an umbrella, it's just like, because you have to protect every inch of your body from.
I blame Mary Poppins. but then this notion of protection and withdrawal, which is in the collection as well, which does tie into these times that, you know, people have withdrawn to protect themselves. So, you know, regardless of how you're worried about the collection feeling out of sync after what happened yesterday in Washington, it still does tie into what a lot of people have in their heads right now. I'm really looking forward to seeing how that is expanded in the collection.
Yeah, yeah, let's see. It was a
question. Well, you've done these leather bodysuits, right? Which are underneath everything. What does that? It sounds a bit like Frankenfurter from Rocky Horror. But how exactly does that translate into the?
Horror is. Have you ever seen The Black Cat?
Yes, the Val Lewton movie.
Is that the director?
Yeah.
It's, with Bela Lugosi and who's the other one? Bela Lugosi.
I thought Vincent Price isn't in it. Was he in a remake or something?
Bela Lugosi and the other horror guy.
Lon Chaney?
No. More, a little earlier than that. Bela Lugosi and... Well, anyway, it is the basis of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's like basically the car breaks down, newlyweds, there was like a castle on the hill, which is this modernist night, like Art Deco place owned by an architect. And in his basement, he has all of his past wives. And he's also a satanic priest and holds satanic rituals in his 1920s modernist villa. And then at the end, they escape and the villa explodes. So it is the blueprint for the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And I know that I mentioned to you one time that when I saw the Rocky Horror Picture Show when I was 13 or something, during that party sequence, you know, there's all the motorcycles going to the house, and then all of a sudden there's that party sequence and Frankenfurter comes down in that outfit and everything. And that was a moment of awakening for me, because I was thinking, I want to go to the world where I wanted to go to that world where that party is. That's the party that I want to go to. And then, fairly recently, I'm at my runway show and I'm looking at like the kids and everything. And I'm going, oh my God, I did that party. I created that party, and I am the Frankenfurter, the Dr. Frankenfurter that I wanted to be.
There's a claim to fame. Frankenfurter of fashion.
yeah, it's fine with me. I'm good with that.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you feel like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things you love are checked by experts. And not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff, with real, hands-on authentication experience. So when you see that shiny blue checkmark that says Authenticity Guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know that eBay's got your back. Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? For me, I got a chef-grade range recently, and now I'm cooking new things every single night. Seriously, no cuisine is off limits. The point is, when we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. I can picture myself with a car full of groceries, cruising down the highway, soaking up the sun with the available dynamic Sky Panorama glass roof. Ugh, pure bliss. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
But I went off on a tangent. We were talking on something else.
No, I was saying the leather bodysuits. And then I mentioned Frankenfurter and this notion of protection and also building, you know, building from the body, like really having this core strength.
I think it started also with those hooded, those bombers that like have a zipper that enclose the hood completely and that have gloves built into them. That feel kind of very restrictive. And yeah, there's obvious S&M overtones. I'm not an S&M person. And I mean, I'm not that fascinated with S&M, but just the idea of that kind of restraint, that kind of why somebody needs to feel suffocated a little bit. Mm. Like, why somebody needs that. But in this day, in the context of what the world has been going through, It made sense. We're covering ourselves up. We're protecting ourselves. We're afraid. We're withdrawing. We are, it's fear. And S&M is based on fears, not just the, not the literal fear of getting hurt, but needing to be hurt to confront some kind of fear. Did that make sense? Or was that
Yeah, because also surrender is a big part of S&M, and in a curious way, trust. You know, because you're going to be suffocated, but you trust you're not going to die from the suffocation. And you know, that whole thing of the safe word and everything, you know, that it's...
Well, S&M was all about dealing with threat. It was taking on your captor's role to fear them less, maybe. Becoming your oppressor. Taking control of that oppression. And that's part of what these clothes are. I mean, I guess that's the essence of S&M anyway. I mean, feeling that you are in control of your oppressor. And I mean, fashion is all about armor, it's all about protection anyway. So this was just a little bit literal.
I guess controlling someone by indulging their urges, mm-hmm. is a fairly kind of convoluted way of looking at that, you know, that sort of that degree of manipulation. It's a, I guess we could go quite deeply into that, but probably better to not in this context. I suppose the notion of the male, I mentioned male conservatism careering off the rail, careening, and one of my favorite words, careening off the rails, probably was maybe more germane to the circumstance that existed a little while ago. Well, maybe not so, but
it was, but that's my thing. It's not gone.
No, I know. I was just going to say, is this somehow in the back of your mind when you think about men, that, you know,
I don't, my men's runway shows are always about men's flaws and men's worst urges, because they're autobiographical. I mean, when I'm thinking about men, I'm thinking about my own experience, and my own experience is very critical, and I'm always very conscious of my worst urges and where they're coming from. And a lot of it, and you know, just doing what I do and just having gotten where I've gotten, there's a sense of horror always. There is a sense of horror because you know, I'm promoting kindness and tolerance and deep kindness. I believe in that so much, but to do what I do, it takes a certain amount of aggression. I have to work myself up to force myself to get things done. And it takes a certain amount of aggression to have an idea and go out and promote it and insist that people recognize it and insist that people recognize the value of my ideas. And it kind of horrifies me. Where is that coming from? Is it coming from really a generous spirit? Do I really believe that this is a contribution that's good for the world? Or is it about my ego? And of course, it has to be about my ego. That's part of it. And that's just one of those necessary evils in life, that ego. But how much free rein do I give it?
Well, you know, fashion is one big therapy session on one level.
It is, and I'm trying to be very honest about mine. So men's collections are usually very critical of men's urges because they're me examining my own and kind of... It's probably... You know, I would probably veer more towards criticism than adulation when I'm talking about myself. So it's automatically going to go to criticism. And I'm going to indulge it And and sometimes even celebrate it a little. I'm like, you know, I just kind of step back and kind of laugh and go, oh my, fuck, I am a monster. But you got to be. You kind of have to be sometimes. So
does this knowledge come with the wisdom? Does this self-knowledge come with the wisdom of age?
Because I thought, you know, I was positive that I was going to be more evolved than I am. I'm going to be 60, and I'm shocked sometimes at how I can't have the control over my emotions. I thought I would by now. I don't have the patience that I think I should have developed and had control over by now. There's no reason for impatience, but it's there. And why? I know better. I know better than this. How do I allow myself to get flustered and be impatient? I'm kind of horrified.
What frightens you?
What makes me impatient or what frightens?
What frightens you?
What frightens me?
Yeah, because I think impatience, you know, there's that sense of urgency that that's at the bottom of impatience. You know, the sense that something has to be done because if it's not done, something bad will happen. You know, I mean, what do you think frightens you?
Well, imprecision, probably. I want everything as precise as possible. I want organization. I want control. Everybody wants control. Everybody wants control. And I recognize that. And I recognize that it's kind of a useless pursuit. But while I'm here, I'm going to be as controlled or control everything about me as much as I can and control it into... And this is where we come into utopias, because I feel like I'm trying to control everything around me in the best possible way. That's what utopian leaders always feel. And they enforce it. And then they enforce it some more. And then the force gets stronger, and then it corrupts, and it turns into a mess. And I mean, this is the history of the world. And you know, you collect acolytes who believe in you, and enough people gather together where there is bickering and
jostling for the proximity to the leader and
jostling. So like things begin with the best intentions, and they devolve. Was that a word? Devolve. Yes,
definitely. Yeah. Devolution.
Right. Right. And then my other fear, I suppose, is hurting people. Because I need to be forceful to get, you know, because I have these deep urges. I have this deep urge to speak and to be listened to. And I recognize that it's kind of futile and it's a little silly, but I mean, that's what one does. And I've had enough encouragement that I feel, okay, people are interested in hearing what I have to say. So I'm going to try and say it as precisely and as... as precisely as possible. I'm going to try and do my best. So I have that sense of urgency. But I mean, that's all of us experience this in one way or another. We all have that kind of sense of urgency.
It kind of comes with the passage of time as well. I mean, I've never felt this year really did make me aware of the fact that I have way less time left than I've already lived. And I had not thought about that before. I was just this aging Pollyanna, you know, who just thought the sun would come up every day and blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly it's just been this really strange. I mean, my fears are like being buried alive, and they're things that kind of horror movie things. I mean, but this year has made, I think it's made everyone way more reflective about the way they live. I mean, and the way they'll eventually die, I guess. So,
do you think that's going to stick, or is it going to be like the 1920s and prohibition and release and the increased hedonism, as if that is possible?
Yeah, but then that consciousness careened into fascism. So I feel this century, I feel the 21st century is going to kind of, you can kind of tab the way stations to the 20th century. You can find correlatives as this century, you know, we're 21, look at what was happening in 1921. You can feel this sense of history repeating. Yeah, maybe we will have a roaring 20s, and maybe it will end up just like the other one did. I don't know how much impact it'll have on me. I'll be very old and gray by that point. But
yeah, we've seen these cycles before, and it's a little bit depressing. That's my suppressed anger.
Do you find your work fulfills you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's surpassed my dreams. I mean, all of us want to be heard, and I've been heard. And I mean, that's been really great, and I'm really grateful for that. And I mean, you can't ask for much more than that.
I feel that if you look at your work, it's like somebody learning a language. Your work, you know, over the years that I've been absorbed in it, the decades, it's really like a new language, and that somebody is learning to speak and becoming more and more proficient, and then teaching it to other people. So
I've been so lucky that I've had the time to develop it. A lot of people haven't had the time. They don't get the time. They don't get the luxury of that time. They're assassinated before they can develop it completely.
But I'm thinking that if you look at the history of fashion, the designers that people revere, or the history of clothing design, if you go back to Travis Banton but I'm thinking more of people like Balenciaga or Azzedine, or people who develop their own language. That is kind of, the word is sui generis. You know, I was talking to Jonathan Anderson about this, that it's, you can only judge them in their own terms. It's amazing. It's kind of like a pure auteur theory of fashion.
Was that a question?
No, that was a statement. That was a statement.
It was a beautiful statement.
I'm just thinking that you know, how you now, with this incredible change in circumstances, how do you gauge your own success with what you're doing, with what you do?
Survival, I guess. But I've survived long enough that I've like totally won. I mean, if I get hit by a car tomorrow, I won. I totally won. I mean, I was listened to more than I ever thought I would be listened to. And that's a huge thing. And I feel like I've done it as honorably as I could. I feel like it's been, I feel like it's been an honorable expression. Imperfect, of course. I mean, the motivations were honorable. I don't know how it came out, but I feel like I kind of did the best I could, and it went over fairly well. And that's the best you can ask for.
You mentioned contradiction with this collection. You're actually barbaric, contradictory terms. That's something that I think that's kind of the grandeur in your work, that there is always a kind of barbarism, which reminds me of those, you know, silent movies you love so much, when there's huge pagan rituals, and even though they're technically about Christianity, you can see that they're all much more into the pagan ritual than they are into the worship of Christ, but which ties into Gethsemane a little bit. Do you think that there is a sort of fundamental contradiction in what you're doing? Do you feel that you're working towards a resolution for yourself, that there's a sort of fundamental question that you're trying to answer?
No, I don't. I think I'm just examining all of the questions that we've just posed ourselves. But I think, you know, there is no answer. For all of our sophistication and technological advances, I mean, there are still huge flaws in everything that we do. And that's not really going to change. We're never going to find that kind of perfection. So we just do the best with what we've got while we're here. And it's that simple. I mean, we're all going to die. We haven't found the secret of immortality. So, and that's the basic human flaw. And that's what everybody is struggling against, some more desperately than others. And, you know, I don't know if I've reached any kind of resolution there either, because I am definitely feeling aged. I'm conscious of that more, I guess.
What do you think?
I'm not really struggling. It is what it is. And I'm not looking for a higher meaning, really.
But when you look at the people who have guided you, and they were a very rich and resonant crowd of sort of inspirations, what can you take from them? The architects and artists and filmmakers and musicians that have inspired you. What's the lineage?
Transcendence. They were not restricted by human and physical laws, I think.
Good.
The music is starting. The music is by Ghost Mane, and it's this. It's a very hostile, aggressive soundtrack. And when my sound guys were working on it, called so upset. Like, you cannot use this music. This with what's going on in Washington. This was 2 weeks ago. With what's happening, have you listened to the lyrics of this music? You cannot use this music. And I said, I've listened to it. I mean, it hadn't occurred to me really. But then when I listened to it again, because I kind of forgot that I'd chosen that music and then we were working on it. And I was going, oh yeah, this is really, but then I thought, yeah, but this is exactly what's happening right now. And I think it makes even more sense. And it's very much about suppressed anger. And there's suppressed anger on both sides. One of the things that made everything disturbing about politics in the past couple of years, what made it even more disturbing was how anti-Trump, when I would speak with friends, they would get on an anti-Trump rant that would become so vicious and so strident that it disturbed me, because it was as strident and as vicious as the supporters themselves. And that's why, like, at the end of these notes, I'm talking about the suppressed rage on both sides of the moral divide. I mean, it's the anti-Trumps were just as scary as the pro-Trumps.
Yeah, but they were fueled by utter frustration that there was nothing they could do about the absolutely appalling policies of that government. I mean, you just spin on the spot with blind rage. You can't even conceive that human beings could be so inhumane to other human beings. And
I felt that. I felt it too, but I couldn't engage in that same kind of rage. What is it, that great line that that Michelle Obama said, when they go low, you go high? I mean,
yeah.
I can't wallow in the mud in that kind of, I can't go there.
Yeah, well, you know, have you ever read Karl Popper, the humanist philosopher? Well, he always said, he said, in the end, you cannot tolerate intolerance. Because if you tolerate intolerance, all it will do is take advantage of you. And so that was what happened to Obama, of course. He tried to go for create a bipartisan Washington, and all that happened was the Republicans took him down, you know, and they took advantage of his better nature. And I mean, that would be my answer to, you can't tolerate intolerance. You just can't.
Well, but in the history of the world, one of the most reassuring thing is that it usually all balances out. I mean, we've survived this long, and that is because there is just a tiny bit more of goodness than badness. Just enough to keep us surviving.
Which is why Trump didn't lose in a landslide, because there was just that tiny bit of goodness.
Exactly, just enough. So, I mean, that's either heartening or disheartening. I'm not sure.
Well, you know, and the other thing, of course, is that there is a great big talk clicking on the species anyway. So all things must pass, which is vaguely reassuring at the worst of times.
Yeah, so just don't complain. Do your best while you're here.
Yes, yeah.
That's kind of my motto.
And so I should say to you, have a wonderful show. Is the weather beautiful in Venice today?
It's not bad. It's not as sunny as it could be, but at least it's not raining, so our fog machines will be fine.
And I actually rented Death in Venice to watch over the holiday, and I didn't get around to it. But you're still enjoying?
You know, we've seen it enough times that I have a feeling by this point it'll just be really long and boring.
Well, it was originally.
I know. I mean, but then it was rapturous with the Mahler and the scenery and everything. But that's the problem with going back to those older movies. You know, because my young team, the kids in my team, they're, you know, 20s. I'm going, you can't be serious that you've never seen Blonde Venus with Marlena Dietrich. And you have to, like, go do that tonight. And then they do, and they're going, well, you know, it was kind of, there were slow moments. And I'm going, oh, yeah, now I remember looking back on it. It was really, really slow. And it all kind of, like, centered on the lighting on Marlena Dietrich's face. And then, you know, a couple of words, and she puffs on a cigarette, and it's like, that's an hour. But then I'm thinking, wait, but these kids, they're in this aesthetic world. Isn't that enough? Isn't that enough for them?
It's the slowness that I find fascinating. I tried to watch Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf again. I hadn't seen it for a long time. Beautiful looking movie.
I actually saw that, like, in the last year again. Yeah. It was pretty fantastic.
the black and white is so gorgeous, but it is so stagey. And it's just how it's funny how, you know, how used we are to sort of a vague, like a semblance of naturalism in things, and the staginess of the kind of delivery of the lines. Everybody sounds like Tallulah Bankhead in it, you know. It's like ba-dump. Yeah. It's just although Elizabeth. So that's my thought for the day. Rick, it's lovely to see you.
I like how you brought up Mary Poppins. I can't get past that. Mary Poppins and umbrellas. How did we talk about Mary? How could, like, in our conversation, Mary Poppins?
And sadomasochism in one conversation. Of course, she is an apogee of S&M in a way. But
discipline and rigor. Mary...
Hmm?
Discipline and rigor.
I like Mary Poppins.
I haven't seen it for a long time, so I'll have to.
I had a Julie Andrews moment when I was a child. She was a big influence.
Julie Andrews?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a Julie Andrews scrapbook when I was a little boy.
I don't think we needed to know about that.
She does the voiceover for Bridgerton. I don't know if you've seen Bridgerton. This.
I see it. Yeah, whoa, that show. I can't believe Mary Poppins needed that job.
You got to work.
Got to work. Even Julie Andrews has to work.
All right, and then we'll end there.
All right.
Thank you, Rick. And we'll be in touch, I hope.
If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, give us a rating, and you might be interested in joining the Business of Fashion's global membership community, BOF Professional. Our members receive exclusive deep dive analysis, regular email briefings, as well as unlimited access to our archive of over 10,000 articles, our new iPhone app, and all of the online courses and learning materials from BOF Education.